You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Greetings, everyone. I'm Mike O'Hanlon with the Foreign Policy Program at Brookings, and I'm privileged today to be hosting three esteemed colleagues from the American University in Afghanistan, professors there, all patriots in their country, all committed to the future well-being of their nation, and all very courageous and distinguished and accomplished already in their generally young careers in what they've been contributing. This is a crucial moment in Afghanistan, as most of you will know, and I realize much of our audience is in the United States, so good morning to you, but also some of our audience could be in Afghanistan or in Europe. As this concern about the future of Afghanistan remains very much a priority for all of South Asia, all of Europe, with the NATO operations still ongoing in Afghanistan and many other parts of the world, too. We know friends in Japan, Australia, New Zealand, and elsewhere have been an important part of the overall effort. So wherever you are, thank you for your interest in this great country that I've had the privilege of visiting some 14 times in my life. And thank you for contributing to our conversation today, where if you wish to send in questions, you could do so by email at events@brookings.edu. But we'll get to your questions a little bit later in our hour-long discussion. I want to begin by welcoming, personally, Muska Dastagir, Omar Sharifi, and Omar Sadr. I know them all a bit. I know Omar Sharifi the best. I've had the privilege of visiting with him before in Kabul and Washington. And again, we're really privileged at Brookings, where we have a number of people who have been very, very interested in the Afghanistan issue over the years, not least my colleague, John Allen, the president of Brookings, who was the commander of the military force there some 8 years ago. My colleague, Vonda Felbab-Brown, Bruce Rydell, who helped lead President Obama's first policy review on Afghanistan and Pakistan back in 2009, and Medea Afzal, another scholar. So we're all, as well as other Brookings associates, privileged to be part of this conversation. The way we'll proceed today is after just a few more moments of warm-up and introduction by myself, I will pose a couple of broad questions to each of the panelists and ask them to speak for a few minutes in response to each question, probably go through two rounds of those questions and then a little follow-up before we get to your questions as well. For those who are not following Afghanistan quite as carefully as others, let me just begin with a little bit of broad framing, very brief, however, but I think many of you know that the United States, as we enter 2021, will be soon reaching its 20th year anniversary of its presence in Afghanistan after the 9/11 attacks. That's been a very difficult and tragic period for many Americans and Afghans. But of course, our Afghan friends have been living through difficult times at least since 1979, when the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan, and the United States benefited from the bravery of many Afghans who fought against that Soviet presence. And we cooperated with Pakistan and others to try to drive the Soviets out in a successful effort that was ultimately seen as a big part of why the Cold War ended favorably for the United States. But of course, that was not so favorable for Afghanistan and for Afghans who were left with the consequences of that conflict, ultimately leading to the Taliban taking power in the mid-1990s and controlling the country with some collaboration with al-Qaeda until the United States, with the Northern Alliance and others, overthrew the Taliban in 2001. Since that time, Afghanistan has been a fledgling democracy trying very hard to piece the nation together against the forces of centrifugal separation, conflict, corruption, state weakness, sometimes nefarious actions by neighbors, and of course, the ongoing presence of the Taliban insurgency. Since February 29th of 2020, the United States and the Taliban have had a general understanding on the need for a peace deal. But of course, that could only go so far without the involvement of the Afghan government. And that peace process is about to pick up again in coming days, but it's made essentially no headway yet on power sharing or any other modalities for reducing violence or stabilizing the country. The war continues, even as the United States presence is now down well below 5,000 U.S. troops, maybe even down to 3,000 at this point, more than a 95% reduction from its peak. So a much lower level of American and NATO involvement, but hardly any resolution in sight about how the conflict will end more generally, and with uncertainty about the future presence of Al-Qaeda or ISIS or other extremist groups that might seek to profit from sanctuary on Afghan soil if the country again descends into all-out civil war and anarchy. So we are truly at a fraught moment as the Biden administration prepares to assume power in Washington and figure out its policy on Afghanistan, including whether it would feel obliged to pull all U.S. forces out of Afghanistan by this May, which is the way that some people, not myself, but some people interpret the requirements of the February 29th, 2020 deal that I just referred to a moment ago. With all of that as background, let me stop talking myself and welcome my Afghan colleagues. And I want to begin with the following question, a very simple, broad question, starting with Professor Dasgupta. Can you tell us something about Afghanistan today? Help us understand life and the situation on the ground that we Americans may not be appreciating sufficiently from our vantage point here many thousands of miles away, and the Europeans and others in your region may not understand as well as they should either. So I'm not looking for a comprehensive primer on the state of the country, but just something that you feel is not adequately appreciated or understood. And once we go through that question for each of the panelists, then we'll start thinking about the policy agenda and the future. But again, welcome to all three of you. And Muska, if I could begin with you on that question, please.
Sure. So I hope that I'm coming through clearly enough. I think my connection might be a little bit not too good right now, but I hope I'm coming through nevertheless. I want to give a snapshot overview of some of the thornier issues that we're dealing with domestically, aside from insecurity, and try to comment on what that means for the continuity of our political system. So there is a litany of ills that plague plague the Afghan body politic, including endemic corruption, crushing poverty for the vast majority of Afghans, and something like impunity under rule of law for some strongmen, warlords, etc. There's also a fundamental disconnect between Afghan political elites and the Afghan population. The former play self-interest, they place narrow, parochial, group-based interest ahead of even the most basic civic virtues. But because of a perverse system of reward in our domestic politics, those who can stoke the most rage, those who can stoke the most inter-ethnic strife, inter-community strife, those are the ones who will be rewarded the most in terms of political capital, followership, popularity, etc. When it comes to the government's ability to govern, the Afghan administrative state is still in its nascence. And you can erect formal structures in the image of Western counterparts with all the cogs and gears that nominally constitute a public agency, a public, an institution, a ministry, a department. But political culture takes time to take root. And if we think of political as sort of the institutional grid or the setup of institutions as the hardware, political culture, a political culture that forefronts and prioritizes accountability, transparency, etc., that's the software, and it's really, really pivotal, and that takes time. So as frustrated as I get, as frustrated as we all get, we are just two decades into a trajectory that takes other countries much longer to get right. And I think that brings me to the point that I want to make. None of the ills that, and I've, this is rushed and it's truncated, but none of the ills that I've mentioned so far, however considerable they are, and they are considerable, none of them, in my opinion, point to some deeper moral corruption at the core or heart of the post 2001 political order. And I say this because I feel the need to say this because I see more and more, I note more and more Western pundits and analysts who are sort of hovering around this point, approaching this point from various different angles, and it worries me. It's often used as part of an argument to defend Taliban's claim to govern in Afghanistan, and it's just something that I wanted to highlight. Another point that I really want to make is that the longer something exists, the more settled it becomes as a set of practices, the more it becomes in itself a claim to its own continuation. Disrupting that, continuously, erecting and then dismantling political systems and structures comes at a very steep cost. The cost of that is instability. Because discontinuity becomes the norm, and that's not conducive to stability. It's not conducive to the sort of calm that any political system needs in order to grow, to develop. If every second or third decade you have, constitutional societal upheaval, it starts to feel a lot like experimentation. And I would not want just, having as backdrop what you explained in the beginning, the sort of, the current situation that you described. I would not want that for the Afghan population again. I don't want the Afghan population to be subjected to that again. This is not a site of experimentation. This is not a laboratory. So I guess what I've tried to sort of render here, probably inelegantly and definitely in rushed and truncated form, is a defense of what is evolving right now. Our political system, our polity is, enormously flawed and imperfect, but it is in development. And I think that what is required is time, and I think it's important to preserve and defend it. Another, if I can just quickly add something, another question that comes up here is, what would the past two decades have been about for the international community and for the US if we are going to allow Afghanistan to regress to the, soul-crushing draconian regime of the 90s? And if not that, because Taliban would be squaring off against a well-equipped, well-trained Afghan army and security forces, then, something equally horrific, a civil war scenario, the sort that preceded the Taliban regime in the 90s. So, yeah, a couple of reflections, couple of questions that we might delve further into over the next 50 minutes.
That's a great framing. Thank you, Muska. And I'll come back to you later. I'll be curious to hear more of your thoughts on how this evolutionary process could continue even with a peace deal and power sharing with the Taliban, which seems on its face to be fundamentally disruptive. And yet you've called for the need to try to stay as much on an evolutionary path as possible. So that's going to set up some good discussion when we come back to you in a little bit. Let me first go to Professor Sharifi. And again, sir, thank you for joining us. And I'd love just your take on telling us a couple things about Afghanistan today that we may not sufficiently appreciate here in the United States or around the world.
Thank you very much, Mike. It's a pleasure to be here with you. And if I can just summarize Afghanistan, but not in a long term, but especially in the context of the peace talks and of this, and especially this agreement between the United States and the Taliban, I can say that the most certain thing about about life here and about the feelings here and about the thought and understanding about life here is uncertainty. The deal with the Taliban between the United States and the deal there, created more questions than answers. But at the same time, the way it was done and the way it was rushed and the absence of the Afghan government for the most of that process kind of caused a lot of not only frustrations, but confusion among many of us. Because the way we thought about Afghanistan, when especially in the context of the corona, the war and everything else, is that something has emerged in Afghanistan in the last 20 years that is unprecedented in our history. Not just in terms of infrastructure, not in terms of just how many roads built or schools are good, but the the thing that's actually, I believe, can define Afghanistan for the entire 21st century, and that is to, for the first time, we're allowed to think freely about, to express ourselves openly, to actually to have a space in which we can dialogue and talk about very important things. The first time in which leadership and governance is not just about ruling, but it's also about providing services. And more importantly, for the first time in which that certain values that's like human rights and specifically women's rights now are becoming part of our sort of national discourse. So these, when we imagined Afghanistan in that is for a lot of us here, whether you're living in the cities or outside the cities in the rural areas, that somehow that idea exists. And the peace talk, the way it happened, it kind of caused a lot of uncertainty. And certainly in a sense that the way it was portrayed, the way it was presented, was something of that nothing exists, like it kind of ignored a lot of realities on the ground. Everybody expected the talk, the kind of the talk, there should be an agreement, there should be some understanding with, at least there should be like a settlement, like a negotiated settlement on the Afghan crisis, on Afghan kind of conflict. But the understanding was that the conflict can be resolved when Afghanistan remains connected with the world. Because we kind of, historically, the only time that Afghanistan was overrun completely by all these extremist groups in South Asian, Central Asian, Middle Eastern extremist groups in the 1990s was when Afghanistan completely lost connect, completely was cut from the rest of the world. And the way with all the kind of the year began with us with that fear and kind of evolved with that fear of like what it might be. And then when the talks began in Doha, which was kind of a welcome, you can say this like a welcome step towards some level of understanding, but the but in general, well, and from our side, who we live in Afghanistan, it was like, all right, there should be a talk. But from on the other side, from the international side, what we heard was a sort of like a sense of abandonment by them. And from the Taliban and Al-Qaeda and everybody else, it was a feeling of triumphalism that was sort of kind of defined the whole sort of life here. Now, there are a lot of things that's there are more and more questions about how the situation will go on and what will happen in the coming months, especially with this sort of deadlines that the international forces have to leave Afghanistan. Obviously, in my opinion, when I'm thinking of international forces leaving Afghanistan, it's not much about how many troops, foreign troops, has to be in Afghanistan to fight the Taliban. It's more about like how much we remain connected with the world, because we know for fact that the Afghan army, despite a lot of deficiencies that Moscow John has mentioned in her speech, they are taking the brunt of what's going on for ensuring security and actually also fighting the Taliban and their allies in the region. And then this rush to leave everything kind of, in a way, aggravated and in a way fuels this sense of uncertainty. And this sense of uncertainty, in a way, also led, if you hear what's happening on the ground and today and day by day, it just simply, you know, encouraged Taliban and a lot of their supporters in the region to actually see this whole peace agreement not as a something that eventually led to peace, but actually something that eventually should be like their victory over and they're taking over Afghanistan, which I don't think it will happen. And at the same time, the other thing that kind of confused us quite a lot is the way the whole negotiation with Taliban and the way all this United States Taliban deal was done was it was less to do with actually ensuring security and peace in Afghanistan, not only in Afghanistan but actually for the region, because it was very vague about like not working with Al-Qaeda and everything else. It was more about like the way it was perceived for all of us. It was like the United States wants to leave simply, and nobody actually think about what would be the next step and the possibility of I continue, because for a lot of us with experience of the 1990s, when the lack of international presence in Afghanistan will definitely lead to a certain of regional conflicts and in a way more further destructive regional involvement in the whole country, which probably make the whole idea of the peace process in a way complicated. So now when we think about all of it, I think the only way we can, with this kind of May deadline is coming and stuff, and all this message of triumphalism I can see around in the Taliban, in Pakistan and other places, there's a lot of concern that we're not actually, even with, if the United States, if the international community completely leave Afghanistan, then this peace talks in Doha or whatever, it may not actually have much meaning. And it actually is another step for war. So there is less motivation for a lot of this, I have to say, appreciation or, in a sense, understanding of the peace by itself. But actually, we looking for the whole process, the way it unfolds, is not something that contributes for the lasting peace and actually securing Afghanistan from this extremist groups, but actually might be another step for war. So a lot of uncertainty and anxiety and concerns, I can say, to kind of summarize all of it. For our experience of 2020 and for the whole peace talks with the United, between Taliban and the United States.
That's very helpful and sobering. So from one Omar to the other, Professor Sauder, over to you, my friend.
Thank you, Michael. And it's a pleasure to be here with you. And thank you for arranging this event for us. Let me put a couple of points on the table and then maybe if I can elaborate and maybe discuss it later with you. The very first thing is that I think today we are, the very burning issue at the moment in Afghanistan is the survival of self and the survival of a Republican system. I mean, self because, and the unprecedented level of targeted killing, and at least in the urban centers. And of course, Republican system because it has been threatened by the Taliban, at least not target and not directly by proposing an emirate, but that of course we understand that their alternative is an extremely ultra-radical religious kind of system. Now, we are also caught in a kind of three vicious circles. So to name them, the very first one is an evil terrorist organization. The second one is an irresponsible and a reluctant international partners. And thirdly, what I call as a vicious republic. And let me come to each of them. It doesn't need any kind of evidence that Taliban, the level of atrocities that they are conducting at the moment is quite high. And we can also call it a kind of crime. It's high to the level that it could be called at an international crime or something, which you are deliberately targeting civilians, civil society activists, media activists, and academia. And unfortunately, why I called it's a kind of irresponsible international partners because all our partners has turned a blind eye on what's going on the ground here in Afghanistan. And reluctantly, they just want to abandon whatever was built jointly by the locals and internationals here just because of their own circumstances or the national interests. So it's that's why the second layer is a kind of irresponsible, but at the same time, reluctant international partner. But the most important and third one is vicious republic. I do not want to blame everything on the internationals and the United States, but because what is going on here and the locals should behave responsibly. And when I call it, it's a republic, unfortunately, what you hear these days, at least in Kabul, is a kind of romanticized pronunciation of the term democracy, the term liberalism or republican system without any kind of substantiated argument and very, I don't know, indigenous kind of roots for all this kind of discussions would take place. Now, by a vicious republic, I would like to highlight a couple of the crises that the system is facing, and that has created a kind of vicious republic. First one is it's a kind of what you see as a kind of a structural challenge and problem to the system because there is no rule of law, constitutional constraints are eventually violated by those who are in the government of the day. There is no enough measures to counter majoritarianism. So that's why there is and a structural crisis to the system. Secondly, there's also a normative crisis to the system, and that indicates to lack of what I can call it, which is very central to a Republican system, that's civic virtues. Unfortunately, most of the incumbent political elite are not behaving responsibly. They're corrupt, they're ethnocentrist, and they have turned the state structure into a private firm by owning it personally. So that's why civic virtue is missing. And apart from that, what we have is illiberal elite who have turned the system to a very corrupt system. Thirdly, the other indicator of a vicious kind of republic is ideational crisis. What we have here in Afghanistan, and we try to preserve it, of course, a Republican system, but it is somehow thrown on Afghanistan. There has been little discussion on how to theorize, conceptualize the nature of the system that we have. If it's Islamic Republic or a Republican system, how do we understand it? Simply, for example, how can we differentiate Islamic Republic here in Afghanistan, the model that is practiced here, from other Islamic republics in the neighboring country? When it comes to conceptualization, of course, there's little there on the paper. And that matters because we have not been able to present a concrete idea of Afghanistan in order to mobilize the people, mobilize the masses, and give them a concrete answer. And finally, it's a kind of, there's also a kind of functional crisis. And that is what was suggested earlier also by my colleagues. And what you see is the corruption, lack of good governance, right? The state machinery is not functioning well. So it's all functional crisis. So all these four elements coming together, it has created a vicious kind of republic. Now, for us, the common people, the educated here in Kabul, we are trapped between a number of options that all of them are not desirable for us. Of course, no one wants to go back to the Emirate system of the Taliban. But at the same time, no one is also willing to live under a vicious republic who is dysfunctional, corrupt, run like a private firm by the incumbent people of the state, right? So unfortunately, I think Afghanistan is in a very painful kind of days at this moment. And its destiny has been shaped, unfortunately, by an orchestrated peace process, by an enforced peace process, which is not organic. Organic in the sense that, I mean, the peace process did not evolve from within the layers of the society, and two sides of the conflict, two parties to the conflict, did not come by their will to this negotiating table. You see, one side of the conflict is quite arrogant, rejecting whatever is there on the table without giving a little concession. And unfortunately, our international partners has reinforced such kind of arrogance of the Taliban. So for me, first of all, this the peace process and the deal which took place in February is what I call it. It's a kind of orchestrated kind of agreement, rather than being organic one. Now, what is the way out? Having highlighted the three vicious circles, the vicious republic, reluctant, irresponsible partners, and also an evil tourist groups that we are facing, it's quite difficult to come up with a proposal. What's the way out? But of course, it's important for all of us to understand the nature of the parties, the nature of this conflict, and to not romanticize the outcome that we are not willing to understand its consequences on the local people here on the ground, in Afghanistan. So at least we can do is to push and try to preserve the system which has been created in the last 18 years. Of course, there are varieties of problems and crises. And try to, first of all, I think, we need to reform here in the Kabul. We need a thorough and institutional reform in Kabul, because until and unless you don't have the system intact, even if a peace process is signed with the Taliban, there is a high risk that the system will collapse. And that reminds me the collapse of system that Afghanistan had 30 years ago in the 90s. And that's, I think, that no one wants here, at least in Afghanistan, in the region, and international partners. But we need to think thoroughly about all of this and behave responsibly. I think I will stop here, and then if there's a question, I will take.
Thank you, Omar. And you've begun the policy discussion, which I wanted to then go to with Omar Sharifi and Muska Dasgagir before we go to audience questions. And we've got a number of audience questions coming in. So let me just move smartly along in that. But going now to Omar Sharifi and then Muska, if I could ask, what do you recommend in terms of policy going forward? And a couple of things that are on my mind. Do you think that NATO forces should depart Afghanistan in May? Do you think that's required by the February 29th deal? And even if it is required, do you think we should ignore that requirement because it would be a bad development? Do you see certain kinds of models of power sharing that could work? And maybe could you give an example? I know that Muska, you've written about this a bit, and at the Atlantic Council and elsewhere. And I know, Omar, you thought about this too. So at least in terms of the policy agenda going forward, at least two questions that are on my mind would be, what should NATO and the United States do with military forces starting in May? And then secondly, can you give any kind of concrete example of what meaningful power sharing with the Taliban might look like? So Omar Sharifi, over to you, please.
Well, I mean, my reading of the agreement was not like a specifically, it was rather different in a sense that I'm not sure if every force has to leave Afghanistan. But in my opinion, if that is the interpretation, that all international forces have to leave Afghanistan by May, I also thought that it must be based on the realities, on the facts on the ground. The facts on the ground is that we don't see actually a break between Taliban and Al-Qaeda. We see actually an expansion of Al-Qaeda and kind of consolidation of it within the Taliban. Their level of operation in southern Afghanistan in areas border with Pakistan, especially in the south of Ghazni area and Helmand and Kandahar, and we see that Al-Qaeda not only kind of simply disappeared or Taliban cut the relationships, but they are cooperating and congratulating each other for an ultimate victory. So I think with that, in a sense, with that in mind, I wonder what it means to leave. But at the same time, I have to be aware of the realities that maybe a lot of the internationals, especially the United States, are quite very tired. They don't want to have troops in Afghanistan, and actually maybe that's our fight. In my opinion, that is kind of the way the threat in Afghanistan right now, the way the whole idea of having a joint government or like a peace process, the way it's structured, it's very confusing. I mean, as I explained before, the Taliban and their allies in the region see this as another last step towards victory. We see the targeted assassinations right now in Kabul. That's kind of a symptom, because we have the same type of assassinations in 1988 and 1989 on the eve of the Soviets withdrawal from Afghanistan. A lot of Afghan intellectuals who were living in exile, anti-communist sort of intellectuals, were like systematically assassinated in Peshawar, in Pakistan, in that period. So, the way the Taliban kind of the Taliban attacks in the last couple of months, though not very successful, but in different parts of the country, it seems that they are not actually preparing for sort of like a settlement, peace settlement. And we all expect, based on a lot of evidence provided by the NDS and other international organizations, that they are preparing for massive operations in the spring and summer. So with all that, I wonder if kind of the complete withdrawal of the United States or international forces from Afghanistan actually will help the peace process to go on. So this is the first thing. Second, so what we can do and how we can move ahead. I believe that the presence of international community in Afghanistan, in a sense that is kind of based on an understanding of the reality on the ground, in a way help peace process in Afghanistan. With what we've witnessed in the past, that with the lack of the presence of the international in Afghanistan, diplomatically, whatever, in 1990s, Afghanistan turned into a battleground, a competition field area for a lot of neighboring troops, especially we've seen even the Pakistani military intervening for the sake of Taliban, to protect the Taliban after 1995. So there is no guarantee that the Taliban and the others will not push and with Al-Qaeda and try to overrun part of the country. A presence of international community, whether kind of even like a token force, some sort of kind of show the international resolve in Afghanistan, might, in my opinion, will help the process. The second issue is, without experience of this, the transition of all the militant groups from being a militant group into a political group in Afghanistan has been rather problematic. With the experience of the Mujahideen in the 1990s, we witnessed that they actually had time to do the transition without without kind of an international support. They fragmented, and then what we had at the end of the day, Al-Qaeda and all the other groups take advantage of that, and they kind of build their base in Afghanistan. For Taliban, in order to kind of transform themselves from a militant group into a political entity that is capable of having a normal, meaningful peace discussion in Afghanistan or in the region, and actually to separate themselves from Al-Qaeda, Lashkar-e-Tayyiba, and all these other groups. We need to have a very strong international presence and kind of not only presence mentality, but also presence intellectually, diplomatically, and politically. And that will probably, in my opinion, that will help the transition for these militant groups to kind of transform themselves into a somebody that's capable of actually having a dialogue right now. With suddenly everybody leaves, I'm worried that actually, I'm afraid that it might actually deepen the crisis, and we may never see that things, and actually Al-Qaeda and other groups may take advantage of it. So specifically based on our experience in the 1990s. Thank you.
Thank you. Muska, same questions to you. And, you know, I'm especially curious as well about your specific ideas on power sharing, because you've been talking and writing about that subject so much. Thank you.
So I think I'm going to start with the question on what needs to happen from this point on going forward. And I'm going to try and also, you know, touch upon your question on a withdrawal. Should it happen? How should it happen? But in a slightly roundabout way. So I knew you were going to ask this question. And I've been thinking that, you know, I suspect that the Trump administration might have deduced or devised a strategy for Afghanistan by balancing the winsets of the parties to the conflict, specifically Afghanistan and Pakistan, and seeing which of those overlapped the closest with the U.S. winset or the U.S. first order preferences for how they wanted to wind down the war, for how they wanted to end the war. And presumably, they saw more convergence with the Pakistan / Taliban winset or order of preferences than they did with Afghanistan. It could also be the realization that whatever animates Pakistan's policy preferences vis-a-vis Afghanistan or Pakistan's / Taliban strategy vis-a-vis Afghanistan is felt so much more intently or plots in so much higher on their foreign policy objectives than Afghanistan does for U.S. foreign policy. You know, if either one of these two are correct, and I think some version of it probably comes close to what is the case, then that was myopic and irresponsible on the part of the Trump administration. I think its officials, I think the architects of the strategy that we've seen unfolding over the past 2 years sort of stared themselves blind on the putative electoral dividends that would arise from ending the war to such an extent that other important considerations sort of fell away, including that, you know, you don't solve a problem, you don't solve a complex issue, a malaise, by recreating the conditions that led to, you know, that generated it in the first place. And this has been a very illogical feature of the Trump administration's courting of the Taliban, because to paraphrase the former French president, Valéry Giscard d'Estaing, there is no question of returning to the pre-2001 situation, only for the reason that the pre-2001 situation included the conditions that led to its own violent demise. And this was, as we all know, triggered by the attack on 9/11. So with the Taliban not changing course and continuing with its campaign of violence, you know, there is this perverse circularity to what the Trump administration has sought to do. So my advice to the Biden administration would be: factor into account that only a sustainable peace can be the logical conclusion to the past two decades. Anything less than that, I think, would likely mean a continuation of war. So let that be the point of departure for any sort of strategy that would be undertaken vis-a-vis Afghanistan, and work back from that. In terms of a withdrawal, should there be a withdrawal, even if the February 29th, 2020 deal stipulates that a withdrawal take place in May, I don't think the time is right for that. I see a lot of recalcitrance. I don't see any sort of tolerance in Taliban's behavior. It's very, very worrisome. And there are various different theories as to continuing with the Doha process while targeting and assassinating educated youth and journalists, etc., on the ground in Afghanistan. We might get into that a little bit later, but none of that inspires confidence. None of it inspires confidence. You mentioned that I wrote two pieces a couple of months ago. I wrote a policy brief for AUAF, and I wrote an article for the Atlantic Council. And in both of them, I contend that maybe it's a very intuitively self-evident idea that a workable power-sharing format would have to be a political arrangement that allows for contradictory impulses to come to rest on it. So that would be, on the one hand, whatever informs the Taliban vision for an emirate, and on the other hand, what informs the government's vision for a democratic republican polity. And I've spent the past couple of months thinking a lot about how much disagreement a functional rights-based political order can encompass within it before it starts to come apart at the seams. And the conclusion that I reach again and again is, yes, it absolutely has to be a political system that can stomach, that can handle a great degree of political disagreement. It cannot be one that confers primacy, that confers dominance to a single faction, a single group, that then imposes on all others a specific way of life, a specific denominational system of belief, etc. That's simply not going to work. And looking at what the Taliban seem to be pursuing right now, these two articles I authored during a fairly optimistic moment. It was from late September to December, where there was some cautious optimism on my part. But from what we've seen over the past month, especially over the past couple of weeks, with violence escalating, sort of a very insidious form of violence, the targeting of, educated youth, etc., I no longer see Taliban being able to compromise in that way. I no longer, they insist on their first order preferences. I don't think they would be content with, making do with second and third order preferences and sort of compromising with the Afghan government. The sort of political and social order that I foresee for Afghanistan, given just the tapestry that we are of different communities, different ethnicities, much like the U.S., actually, it has to be a pluralist social and political order. And with Taliban's vision, I don't see that sort of, I don't see the spaciousness allowing for that. That's
sobering. Well, excellent. Let me bring in audience questions. Here's what I'd like to do with your permission. Starting in that same order, Omar Sadr, Omar Sharifi, and then Muska. Let me ask each of you to respond to a couple of the questions that I'm about to read to you. I'm going to read them all. So I hope you all have pen or pencil, because I think we only have time for one round of responses from each of you. But you'll each have about 5 minutes. So that'll give you an opportunity to elucidate in some detail on the one or two questions where you feel most powerfully about responding. And I think that will also allow you to add any concluding or final thoughts as well. So about 5 minutes each for the following list of about eight questions. So please, and some of these you've already touched on, and that's why I'm not really sure how to handle this besides just, reading the questions. Question one, who is responsible for the current problems in Afghanistan most? The United States or the Afghan government? The questioner didn't allow for any other possibilities. I might blame somebody besides those two, but that's the way the question was phrased. what obstacles and opportunities will the Biden administration face specifically? And also a related question, does former Vice President Biden's well-known views on the Afghanistan mission of you know, 5 and 10 years ago, does that influence the way that Afghans shape their expectations about what he will do now that he's about to become president? Specifically, the skepticism about a large-scale state building or large-scale counterinsurgency effort and the preference for a more narrowly tailored counterterrorism approach by the United States with its role in Afghanistan. Specific question about the peace talks, how are women being represented at the peace talks in Qatar? Another question about the state of education in Afghanistan, and do you feel that there's adequate investment in education, not only in the cities, but in the more rural areas, and how can that be furthered with or without a peace deal? Another question has to do with if the United States wants to safely end its war or its role in the war in Afghanistan, what steps should it think about taking specifically in the next few years? Another question, and I'll start to wrap up here in just a minute. I know I'm throwing a lot at you, but again, please be very selective and just pick the ones that you know that you most are moved by or most feel important to respond to. How can economic development continue given the security situation? And has economic development even continued in recent years, or has it essentially been stuck? Question about the Taliban. Have they changed at all? I think you've all three spoken to this question to some extent, but we can put a sharper point on it. Is there anything different about the Taliban today from the Taliban of the late 1990s when they were in power? If there were a successful peace deal, do you think that that would really end the problem of extremism and terrorism in Afghanistan, or would there be parts of the country that were still relatively ungoverned where that kind of insurgency or unrest would continue? And finally, two more questions. Are there any neighbors in Afghanistan that are benefiting somehow from this war, whether economically or politically or otherwise, making them less inclined to support a peaceful outcome for negotiations? And the very last question, for all of you or for any of you, could you list two or three things that Afghan security partner nations and international non-governmental organizations could do to improve the situation further in Afghanistan? So, you know, again, sort of making the broad policy agenda as specific and concrete as possible. That's a lot to throw at you. But again, I'm asking each of you to just handle one or two questions together with any concluding thoughts for about 5 minutes. 5 minutes each, starting with you, Professor Sauter.
Well, thank you, Mike, for that. And if you allow me to just speak a bit about this, the question that you asked about the modalities of power sharing, and then I will come and pick one question from whatever you throw on us. On modalities of power sharing, I don't have a particular formula so far, but I think we should go back to history and learn some lessons from practices of power sharing in Afghanistan, at least. And of course, the modalities of transitional systems or interim governments. So far, we had in Afghanistan four types of interim government. One interim government came in 1963 during the king, the last king, which was mandated to frame a new constitution. Two other interim governments were conducted during the Mujahideen, which was a kind of model of power sharing. Both of them failed disastrous. The fourth one was the Bonn Agreement, which also presented another model of power sharing and interim government. And now standing at this moment and judging back what the modality of Bonn Agreement, there are so many flaws out there. And I think the last one is also NUG, National Unity Government, which also presented another model of power sharing. Now, we need to study all of these different cases thoroughly and come up with what were the positive outcomes and what were the negative or failures of all these models. And to do that, I think I will present a couple of principles that we should not repeat while coming up with any kind of maybe power sharing model. Number one is that there should be enough checks and balances on any forms of power sharing model which will be presented, so that whoever is on the lead or the head of the system should not be able to exercise kind of arbitrary use of force or power or misuse his or her responsibilities. That's number one. Secondly, we should also not repeat the old formula, the way, the stereotypical way of division of power, distribution of power in Afghanistan. That is one of the primary causes of the conflict here, and that should not be repeated. Thirdly, we should also prevent any form of formation of an institution which provides exclusive use of power by one particular group or segment. For example, clergy. The way that probably Taliban will come up with certain form of power sharing, presenting a kind of an institution which should be controlled only exclusively by ulama and mullahs and clergy. So that should be prevented. No institution should be an exclusive control of one particular segment of population, particularly the clergy. Now, coming up to the questions, I think I will pick the question that you raised about the obstacles and opportunities of Biden administration as far as this deal and process is concerned. First of all, I think one obstacle is that the administration receives or inherits a deal which has not been done by themselves, but somehow they don't have any other option just to receive it, which has been signed by their predecessors. And this deal cannot be violated. Somehow I feel that the United States cannot come out of the deal with the Taliban in February. That will have certain costs to administration, and that's certain obstacle. And now the administration should somehow manage this, wherein it should not fall in the trap of the Taliban and give them a blank check and leave everything for them, so that their partner in Afghanistan, in Kabul, should be left out without anything in the Republican system here. And there are a bit of scope and opportunity, and I think the way that the deal has been violated a couple of times, and we have certain evidences for that one, that provides a space for the United States new administration to push a bit. At least the very first simple thing that administration can do is, I think, to push the time frame of withdrawal of the forces from end of April, early May, I think, for a couple of more months. And that will provide us more space to think more, and also to see how the peace process unfolds. And I'm afraid that peace process will not come to a conclusion in the next 3 months. And so it's a very painful, long, it will be a long process. Until and unless there is some miracle happen or a kind of unprecedented level of force is used on both sides, the Taliban and the government of Afghanistan, so that they should not have any other option except to reach a deal. But that's not somehow which is possible. So that's why I think we need more time for the process. And we should not rush to a conclusion. And that's why if the forces remain here for a couple of more months, that's one of the solutions. And that's possible. I think that's one of the opportunities. I will stop here, I think.
Omar, thank you very, very much. And we'll go to Omar Sharifi.
All right. So I think I have to be even quicker than that. I'll take two questions on that. What is it safely for the U.S. to end the war, and what it takes in the next few years? I think that for the United States and the international community to kind of safely end the war in Afghanistan, and for Afghanistan to get into peace, is I think for the international community, and specifically the United States, they have to actually continue to trust and invest on the opportunities and that kind of still exists in Afghanistan. Afghanistan is still right now, for good or for bad, despite a dysfunctioning problematic administration. I don't go as far as to call it dysfunctional. There is an Afghanistan army, there is a security force that's actually capable of defending the country with appropriate international support and actually do very, very kind of adequate anti-terrorist operations. And even if someday tomorrow, even with a peace with the Taliban, which I doubt, any peace with the Taliban would end kind of the problem of extremism in the region, because Taliban are composed of different groups, and most of them are actually based in Pakistan, I think the Afghan security forces are capable of actually kind of managing it to a large degree. So in my opinion, building, kind of investing on what has kind of emerged and established in Afghanistan in the last 20 years may bring a lot of dividends in the future for this kind of safe use withdrawal from the end of this war and peace. And the fact is, have the Taliban at all changed? I am confident that there is absolutely no evidence that the Taliban fundamentally changed their core messages, their ideas since 1996. In terms of their views on women's rights, in terms of human rights, in terms of governance, in terms of like militancy, in terms of support for these different groups, in terms of like violation of freedom of speech, anything that somehow kind of shows that Taliban have changed, we do not have anything. Some of the Taliban go on and talk with international experts and journalists and pretend that they have changed, but on the ground, when we are living here and seeing it every day, we don't see, and especially I, who lived all my life in the Taliban, experienced Taliban rule in Afghanistan, I don't see much change in terms of their core message and behavior. Thank you.
That's extremely sobering, and I hope it's one of the messages that resonates powerfully with our audiences. Whatever we think about the prospects for the peace talks, we have to understand the views of the respective parties. Muska, over to you, please.
All right, thank you. I'm sitting in darkness. Sorry about that. Electricity just went out. I'm going to answer very briefly the question on, there's a plethora of obstacles that face the Biden administration. Something that I really want to make sure that I mention before we stop is I think that the way that aid and assistance is rendered needs to be optimized. The way it's been, the modalities through which it's been disseminated, the way it's been done over the past two decades, the past 2 decades has been very unfocused, uncoordinated. There's been a tendency for siloing. And I think at this point, given the stakes and given where we are, there is a need to invest heavily in the security sector. It needs to be a lot more focused. Interventions need to be a lot more targeted instead of, just giving sort of willy-nilly to a plethora of different, sectors. I think the goal at this point, the objective is to have a self-sufficient Afghanistan, an Afghanistan that can defend itself, right? So I think that prioritizing the way that the security sector is invested in is really, really important. And I think that could combine very well with a residual limited counterterrorism force, an American CT force. I know that doesn't go over very well with the Taliban, but I at this point it's very hard to envisage a future in the near or medium term without that sort of guarantee. So yeah, I think that brings us up to 2 minutes left.
Well, you've all been fantastic. I want to just say, as a friend of Afghanistan and an admirer of Afghanistan, that the three of you represent the reason why many of us believe still in the country and its future. You've all been very critical of the Taliban. You've been rather critical of your existing government and power brokers. And yet you collectively represent a part of Afghanistan and maybe the real soul of the Afghan people. That is a third entity that is, I think, really the hope of the country and the hope for the future. And I know that President David Sedney of the American University in Afghanistan, who helped me conceptualize this event, shares that core belief in the future of your country, which is why he's dedicated so much of his career and life to the service of Afghanistan. I want to really express my admiration and support as we go into this difficult period of figuring out what's going to happen next with the Biden administration, the peace talks. Since we are finishing up just on time, I can't help but ask one final question with just a brief response from each of you, because we haven't even talked about COVID. And as we try to make sense of the situation in Afghanistan today, this may be tangential to the main issue, but I wonder to what extent the COVID pandemic has made all of these other problems worse, or is it almost a different kind of problem altogether that doesn't really affect the issue of the violence and the peace process? Or does it even potentially open up opportunity somehow? Not that I can easily fathom how that might be the case, but I'm just wondering how COVID affects life there, how bad the health crisis is, and what the ways in which COVID may affect other parts of Afghan politics and Afghan challenges, may manifest themselves. Muska, could you begin with that question, please, just very briefly? You're still on mute, my friend.
Sorry.
Thank you.
So I just very briefly, I don't see it having any sort of, you know, any discernible impact on the fighting, on the, the pace of violence or anything like that. I might be wrong in that, but I haven't seen it either slow down or accelerate or have any sort of impact on it. I don't know what my colleagues will say here.
Omar Sharifi.
Well, I co-authored an article with a friend of mine on the effect of COVID in Afghanistan, published in American Ethnologist. What I've witnessed here is because our government was not able to actually respond properly. We witnessed a massive community level mobilization to actually help each other and sustain, especially most of the people kind of earn their money daily. And then it was communities got together, raised their money, distribution of the food and everything. So even when the Taliban and the same during the COVID, the Taliban attacked a maternity hospital, shot the babies and the mothers. And others, and there was the community who was mobilized to actually provide food for the need in their own neighborhoods. They went and they volunteered to help the kids whose mothers were shot and those babies who were injured and stuff. So what we actually in Kabul and Mazar-e-Sharif and the several villages that I've actually worked as an anthropologist, we witnessed like a massive level of community mobilization to actually help each other in the absence of effective government, even despite the Taliban threats.
Thank you. Omar Sadr, any final thought?
Yeah, so it's clear that our national health system is disastrous, and we don't have enough data to show us the effect of COVID on various walks of life and different aspects of conflict and peace. The recent interview of President Ghani and CNN, when he was asked the same question, he gave an answer which is totally wrong. He said the system managed well, but what's on the ground, it shows that was disastrous. But as far as the effect of COVID is concerned with respect to the conflict, I think there was minimum level of influence or effect on that under the government. But when it comes to peace process, why not? Yeah, it delayed the peace process, particularly the first wave of COVID, logistically created certain challenges for different delegates, particularly the youth delegate, and also where to conduct the talks, that created certain logistical challenges. But in terms of conflict, I didn't see anything. Yeah, thank you.
Again, thanks to all of you. Again, very clear messages about the importance of patience. And certainly you have to be patient, whether we Americans think we have the choice of leaving or not. You are all dedicated to your country, and you're willing to be patient and resolute. You've been very clear in expressing concern about the Taliban and where they are as an organization, where they are in their ideology and their willingness to make peace. And I think I heard consistent messages of hoping for international engagement to continue over an extended period and not just through May. That seems to have been a consistent thread in addition to many other important points, but also a clarion call to your fellow Afghans in government and elsewhere to continue to try to build a stronger, more effective, more efficient government, and one that serves the people of Afghanistan better and therefore takes away some of the rallying cry of the Taliban. I think I heard all of that today, and I heard it very eloquently. So let me just, on behalf of Brookings, thank you again, wish you the very best for the new year, and the same to all Afghan friends. So signing off from Brookings in Washington.